Hello to all the product lovers out there. This is really exciting as it is our first episode of Product Superheroes, and we are ready to kick things off strong with a great UI UX superhero, Kate Sandberg, who's here to talk about what the heck UI UX is and really some ways of improving it in our own products. But first, what is Product Superheroes and why should you be listening to this podcast? As a quick introduction, my name is Bob Schoenfeld, and I've been a product manager for various products for around 10 years. And one of the things product managers do is we look at all the really exceptional products out there and tear them apart to see what makes them so good. We look at everything from features and functionality, breaking apart user interfaces, looking at the data that drives the product, how it's gathered and used, and sometimes it even gets so granular as looking at the coloration and the shading of individual buttons. Now, all this is great information and helps us make better decisions with our own products, but often leaves a bigger mystery of why they have chosen to do things in this way. Sometimes even going against what seems like other more logical solutions. But in doing so, have made great accomplishments. And that is what led me to the people behind these great product decisions. These are the product superheroes, the ones that go above and beyond in the name of product excellence. They fight the typical and help build an amazing new world. Every couple of weeks, we'll be sitting down with these heroes and talking to them about a variety of topics relating to design, development, and management of products. And we'll hopefully be learning some new techniques we can use on our own products. Now, being that this is our first episode, we made a rookie mistake. We set up the equipment, and one of the mics, my own, was turned off and never got turned back on. The result is that my audio will be extremely low throughout the interview, and so I apologize for that. We will try to level it out with the editing process and ensure that future recordings will have some great audio. Case's mic does work great, however, and he really has the interesting things to say. So enjoy the episode. Maybe you'd like to be a guest on the show or know a product superhero we should have on, please send them my way at bob@productsuperheroes.com, or you can catch me on Twitter at @mightybobarian. Thanks, and enjoy the show.
Threatened by product mediocrity, heroes rise to save the day with superhuman abilities in product management, design, and development. They battle to create a world filled with product excellence.
The Emperor does not share your optimistic appraisal of the situation.
These are the Chronicles of the Product Superheroes with your host, Bob Schoenfeld.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We have a really exciting subject today. Today, we're going to be talking about UI UX. You know, you've seen it everywhere. If you go to job postings, they're all asking for UI UX experience now. And so we really want to dive into what the heck that is. Joining us today is Case Sandberg. So, Case, I met Case during Startup Weekend. It was the first enterprise Startup Weekend. We had a really great time working together. I was really amazed by what he created out of that Startup Weekend. Looking at his UI and UX, it was phenomenal. So Case comes out, he dropped out of high school and turned to his frequent freelancing into a full-time web agency. To get his foot in the door of Silicon Valley, he moved to the Bay Area to work full-time for one of his oldest clients. That startup was recently acquired by Shutterfly, where he is now currently working as a front-end engineer. Did I get all that right?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is going to be great.
Yeah, so what kind of things have you been up to recently?
Just mostly been working a lot. The acquisition closed about 6 months ago, so we're still kind of doing integration, stuff like that with Shutterfly and trying to optimize both our company and, you know, our fulfillments with them. So.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. And what was the transition a pretty easy one when it...
Yeah, you know, it's been pretty smooth. We're finally moved into their offices now. So our lease was up at our building, and so they're, like, transitioning us into their offices, which they're pretty cool. So I can't complain.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. So the topic today is, of course, UI UX. So what the heck is it?
Yeah, so, I mean, and I'm going to use my favorite explanation here. You can Google it. If you Google UI serial or UX serial, you'll get this analogy. I think it's fantastic. But essentially, think of a bowl of cereal. You're eating a bowl of cereal, right? You eating the bowl of cereal is the experience it, right? You experience the cereal, you're eating the cereal, you're like, man, my life is awesome. That's the user experience. The UI is the spoon. So you're using that tool, the spoon, to get at the cereal. And so that's the user interface of you eating the spoon.
Nice, nice. Yeah, one of my favorite user experiences with cereal is the milk afterwards. That's always a great part. And then you see some new UI coming out of it where there's these new bowls out there that have the ability to drink the milk while you're eating your cereal. So it kind of channels the milk on this little side straw almost.
That's awesome. Wow, I didn't even know.
Yeah. So to kind of break down it, UI is user interface. It's the things that you are touching and feeling, the buttons you're pushing. And then UX is kind of the feeling that you're getting through that. Does it have a nice workflow as you're going through? Are you accomplishing your goals? Is it making you happy? You know, it's that kind of uplifting feeling.
Yeah.
And one thing I always tell people, because there's different kinds of levels to the UX as well. When you're going for a designer position, generally you're diving in deep to, this is the product we're doing. What's the experience to that product? As a product manager, I tend to take it even higher and say the whole user experience is from the moment you acquire the customer, their experience going, you know, being acquired, going through the software, even their experience talking to customer service and, you know, if they have to have, you know, support or, you know, a return or what, you know, their experience with that. And one of the examples I always point to is Apple. Apple, that's one of the things they really won people over with is their user experience, not just when you boot up your laptop for the first time, but just that feeling you get when you're opening the box and how perfectly put together that box is, and you know, and then if you ever have to go to support, you go to the Genius Bar and you have a really great experience there.
Yeah, you know, and it's crazy, and you know, you go there and they flag you by your hair color and your shirt, and they'll come and walk over to you when it's your appointment time, you know, and know who you are and know your name, and you know, returning stuff, you know, they'll ship boxes to your house for you to put, you know, your stuff in to go get it repaired and whatnot. So, I mean, they really have the user experience down, like pretty much on all of their channels.
Yeah. Yeah, and another great one was Asus, or Asus. I always get their name. It's a little tricky name. It's comes off of Pegasus, so it's like Asus.
Yeah.
I've always had a great experience with them as well. More on the computer building side, because
okay.
I build a lot of computers, and when you're building computers, you inevitably have motherboards that are DOE, dead on arrival, or DOA, dead on arrival. And a lot of the companies I've dealt with, it's a really big pain because when your motherboard is bad, you have to, the return policy is usually, okay, well, you have to send it in and then we have to test it out and then see if things are working. And then if it is broken, we'll send it back to you. We'll fix it and send it back to you. And then the whole time your computer is down. And it's a hassle because then you have to take all the components out, send it away, have your computer down for several weeks, and then by the time, you know, they get done, they bring it back, you put all your components back in it, boot it up, and it's still a problem. With Asus, one of the things I loved about them is they're one of the few companies that still do the drop ship, where it's, if you have a bad motherboard, you call them up, say, hey, I put this in, my motherboard's bad. They immediately send you a new motherboard. You take your old motherboard out, put it in the box, send it away, and pop in your new motherboard, and hopefully everything works then.
Wow.
So then you're down maybe a day or two that it takes you to swap the motherboards. So
that's fantastic. I didn't know they did that.
Yeah. So getting, you know, we're kind of giving examples. Do you have any other examples of good UI, UX, or even bad UI?
Yeah, well, I mean, going back to the analogy, I love this analogy. Like, you guys just got to go look it up. But, you know, imagine trying to eat a bowl of cereal with a fork, You know, you still get an experience because you're still getting the cereal, but you don't get the milk. It's not the full experience, you know. And similarly, if the cereal's different, you know, it's a bad user experience. If you don't like the cereal, you're not, you know, it's not going to be great. So, you know, in that respect, from the analogy, that's a fantastic way of explaining bad UI. But, you know, bad UI is all around us. And it's funny because most people only talk about bad UI and UX because it's right there in your face. You know, when you have a problem with something, it, you know, a lot of times it is because of bad UI or UX, which is it's really hard to diagnose good UI or UX because it's just so easy. You know, if it's doing its job, you shouldn't have to think about it. You know, it's when it's not doing its job that it's like right there in your face.
Yeah, yeah. So, I'm trying to think of some examples of some bad UI. Usually the bad UI UX, I try to forget.
Yeah.
So it's always hard to bring up examples, and it always makes me feel guilty that I'm like, oh, their site sucks. But generally, you know, the way I gauge it is, can you accomplish your goal and how easy it is to accomplish your goal on that site? So if you find yourself getting halfway through and then you're frustrated with the site and you just quit, then that's, you know, a bad UI or a bad UX experience.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, similarly, like Google preaches all the time this 2-second load time that you should, all of your pages should load within 2 seconds because, you know, the amount of users that bounce or leave while the page is still loading, like, increases dramatically after that 2-second mark. And so, you know, that's a good example of bad user experience across the board if it takes 10 seconds for your page to load. So.
Yeah. Oh, how times have changed. I remember the load times of a 9600 baud modem. You're like, I want to see that picture. Okay, I'm going to go make a sandwich, make a cup of coffee, come down. Oh, it's still loading.
Wow, yeah. I luckily didn't have to live through any of that. So,
so now that we're talking kind of about the good UI and bad UI, how do you measure the, you know, a good UI and bad UI? You know, it's because it's one of those things where it's kind of weird. It's almost like a mix of science and art, and art tends to be very subjective. And so it's one of the, how do you really gauge if it's good or bad when you have a subjective object like that?
Yeah, you know, and I mean, one of the biggest things, you know, from a standpoint of creating, you know, UI and UX, you know, you have to, you know, set out the goals that you want to achieve. And if you can achieve those goals most efficiently, I think that's a success. So like Google, for example, on their home, you know, their homepage, their landing page, you know, they really want you to search. Like they literally have stripped the page down to like 6 things, and one of them is a huge ass search bar because that's what they want you to do, you know. And it loads really quick, you know. I think they had achieved, you know, a good user experience because you come there generally to search, you know, and you can search really easily.
Yeah, and I remember they did that during a time when you had the other search engines that were highly cluttered, where you would go and you would have the search, but that search box was buried in lists of articles and, you know, log in here to view your mail.
Yeah, well, like Yahoo, you know, and yeah. I don't know what it was, but, you know, as a kid on our computer, it always, when you opened up a tab, it would default to the Yahoo landing page because it had the news and my parents liked reading the news on there or something. But yeah, you know, it's the same. You know, the search bar is cluttered behind things, which, you know, maybe their intention of their homepage was the news, which is, you know, maybe they were successful in that fact that my parents bookmarked it, you know, yeah, to read it every day. But, you know, it really just comes down to what they want to achieve and, you know, hopefully most of your, you know, what they want the customers to achieve. So, you know, it really just depends from a business perspective, you know, and a lot of times, you know, you coming to a site, if you have a bad user experience, there's a lot of cases where maybe you're an edge case because they built it for somebody else, not for you. So.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you touch on a great point there in that it's really, you know, what is your market segment, too, that you're trying to accomplish
Definitely.
Things with. So, you know, if you're building for your parents, then, like you said, the news is the thing that they're going for. So that might be the user experience that you want to develop for. Whereas, you know, other people, you know, maybe they're just looking for search. And so then that's where Google, you know, did a great job at giving them a user experience of, you know, searching. So another kind of, you know, on the product management side that we do to kind of gauge the success factors is we do what's called multivariate testing or A-B testing.
Sure, yeah.
And, And that's usually taking like an experience, and it could be something very simple. So I always use the button example. So say there's an order form, and at the bottom you have a button to submit, and that button is currently red. And you're noticing that, okay, people get through halfway through the form, they kind of fill in stuff, they get down to the bottom where they should submit it, and they don't. And why is that? And it's probably because there's a problem with the UI that's causing a bad UX.
Yeah.
And so what you could do is do a test on it. So take half of your users and send them to a green button instead,
yeah,
and see if that increases them clicking on that button. And so, and then if that does, that's a measurement that you can use to say, hey, this is a successful UI user experience, because now they're able to complete that task and go on to the next steps.
Exactly, yeah. Or, you know, stripping down that form until it's only, you know, the form until it's only things that you necessarily need for them to get through it.
Yeah.
You know, because people having to scroll down and fill in all these text boxes generally is a bad user experience.
Yeah, yeah. That's actually another point that I was reading some book. I can't remember. I've been reading a lot of books lately. But you know, there was a really excellent point about there's additive bonus, additive benefits to an UI. You know, like, oh, if we add this button, they can get to the settings quicker, something like that. But then there's also a subtractive that you need to look at. So do you have things that don't necessarily need to be there? And it really gets into decluttering that interface. So then that way it's easier to go through. One good way to think of it is look at your eyes and how much things your eyes have to look at before it can find the button it needs to get to. And if it's tracking all over that screen, that means your user interface is probably a little too cluttered and you need to start trimming things down, subtracting things that don't necessarily need to be there.
Definitely, you know, and I mean, another really good way to kind of gauge and measure this, and it's not really on the measurement side, it's more on the creation side of it, but you kind of create personas for your, you know, customer segments. And I love the way Square does it. Square is like they do the in-person credit card transactions and stuff with their card reader.
Yeah.
And you go to their homepage, and they have three really distinct pathways for the three people that they're marketing to on their homepage. And, you know, the first one is the guy looking for, you know, really easy mobile payments out and about, and all they really want from that guy is his email address and letting him know that they'll send him a free card reader. Right? They make it super, super easy. You know, the second one is the people with physical storefronts. You know, and they're really pushing on that, their point of sale system, the software, and their really, really sexy looking hardware that holds the iPad and the really nice automatic drawers, you know. And then the third one is people looking to sell things. And it was funny when I was going on, you know, checking this out again last night, was that literally the first thing you see when you go to that page for their marketplace is the pricing. You know, which is really indicative that, you know, people coming to sell through their marketplace really only care about the pricing. So, you know, I think they do a really good job. And, you know, you essentially assume this role of a persona and you walk through the site as if you're that person and you try and make it as frictionless as possible. And I think Square has done a really great job with that.
Yeah, yeah. I have to say they've done an amazing job. You know, in Hawaii, we have a lot of, you know, I moved there, so I'm still, my mind's still there oftentimes.
Sure, yeah.
But there's a lot of mom and pop shops there that really just couldn't afford the typical merchant accounts. And Square has given them an experience that they can now open up shops and sell their little koi pies, but still able to take credit cards, whereas before all they could do is cash. And so yeah, I have to give, you know, Square some kudos for what they built there. So.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, they keep on doing stuff right. And I always say, you know, if you want to find good UI and UX, generally go and look at the big hotshot startups in the Bay Area or in the US that have shit tons of funding. Go and look at them, and they generally have a really good UI and UX, because you kind of need that, you know. It's generally very crucial, unless, you know, you just get really lucky and get funding for some other random reason, which is an outlier case, but it does happen too, so.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's funny. At one interview I was at, they kind of brought up Uber, and, you know, okay, so what's some of the things you would change about Uber? You know, it's one of those typical questions that you have to answer if you're getting into, you know, design or product management and stuff. You know, it's like, how would you change this product? But I kind of laughed at it because it was one of those things where, well, Uber is doing so much right, right, with their user interface and everything. It's what can I learn from Uber, not, you know, what can I change about them? Because, you know, their growth has been phenomenal and their user interface is great, you know, and so, you know, yeah, I'm sure if I dug into it really deep, there might be a couple things I could change. But, you know, their success right now is showing that they're doing things in the right way. And that, you know, there's probably nothing I should be changing. I should be learning from them.
Yeah, you know, and it's really interesting looking at it. You know, it's hard to tell from outside the company because we don't know what their goals are.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting, you know, going through like Uber, for example, and they make it really, really easy to call a car, right? It's one click.
Yeah.
Like you drop a pin, they'll come pick you up. If you want to figure out how much your fare is going to be beforehand, they have like a fare calculator type of thing.
Yeah.
It takes you three clicks to get to it and figure out what your fare is. So that obviously, you know, tells, you know, me from an outside perspective, either they're failing on that front or they're doing really, really well because most of their customers don't really care what the price is. They already kind of know in their head or they're like, yeah, I'm going to pay this anyways.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, I could see where it could be that too, because, you know, the area that they disrupted, the cab service, you never knew. you could try calling and getting them to give you a quote.
Yeah.
But that quote generally would have been wrong. And, so yeah, it was always a guessing game of, okay, I need a cab. I need to go there. You know, I'm just going to have to bite the bullet of whatever the cost is going to be to get there, because I need to be there by that time. So,
yeah.
Maybe that's it, is that they, a lot of the customers don't care, but they really just want that convenience of cab now.
Definitely.
So,
yeah.
So kind of getting into, so we talked about the measurements. So how would you get into building a good UI and UX experience? You know, what would be kind of the creative process to go through?
Yeah, you know, and I personally kind of like to break it down into four main sections. So there's the discovery phase, the design phase, the implementation phase, and then the, like, iterate, test, tweak, or scratch phase. And so with the discovery phase, you know, I really like to sit down and, you know, think for a good while about what problem, you know, we're trying to solve, or what's the underlying problem or, you know, kind of pathway that we want the user to go down. You know, and it really helps, in my opinion, to look, you know, look at similar interfaces and people that are doing the same thing, even if it's not in your, you know, in your market or something. But, you know, I mean, generally, there's a lot of really good UI out there, and you can just kind of look around and get a feel for what other people are doing. And then define key objectives, you know, because it's all about, you know, from a perspective of a builder, it's all about the business decisions behind these things. You know, because half the time the user doesn't know what they want. So you kind of have to guide them on the path that gets them to where you want them, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, what one good thing about really getting into that, that defining them, is it also gives you kind of a baseline of what your goals are going to be. So you know if you've succeeded or not.
Definitely.
You know, that's where I see a lot of failures come out, where those definitions of goals tend to be very vague. It's like,
yeah.
Oh, we're going to build this and it's going to be great and people are going to come. Well, no. Like, what's the exact measurement that you're, you know,
exactly.
Are key performance indicators that you're really, you know, looking to score or win, you know?
Yeah, you know, I mean, and the biggest thing with that is, you know, goals should be a yes or no answer.
Yeah.
You know, you shouldn't be able to say, well, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, yes, I achieved the goal. No, I didn't achieve the goal.
Oh, we had close to the number.
But so that's the discovery phase. And then after that, I usually take it into the design phase, which I do a lot of sketching, you know, again, a lot more looking around as well, wireframes, mock-ups. Galore, like, you know, depending on how, you know, long of a process or how long of a time I have to go through the process, you know, it'll generally be, you know, it could be anywhere from 5 to 15 to 20 different mock-ups, like full mock-ups or sketches and stuff like that. You know, it really just depends on how hard the problem is to solve. And even at that, you know, at that rate, there's a lot of really easy problems that end up taking, you know, me like 2 weeks to figure out, you know, what the best solution for us would be for that.
Yeah, yeah, and I noticed because you know, product management, we ended up getting into a lot of like mock-ups and designs too, which is funny because getting in, I was always saying, oh, well, isn't that the design job?
Yeah.
You know, shouldn't the designers come up with, you know, the look and the feel? But more and more product managers get relied on to at least bring in the initial mocks.
Yeah.
But I notice when I go through the mock-ups, a lot of the thought process that I go through is kind of like what we talked before, is what things do I need to add to get things to the goal, but then also what's things that I should avoid? You know, what are some of the typical menus and stuff that I probably don't need and should avoid that? And then I also tend to, myself, I start, you know, with the an outline. So I do a written word outline of the menu options and the kind of the triggers that I need, and then start building the mock-ups off of that. And I find that helps kind of my flow.
Yeah, you know, and it was great. So I go up to Toronto a lot. My dad lives up there. And he was working for like this really big hotshot ad agency a couple of years ago called Juniper Park. And I went in the office to visit him one day, and it was hilarious. It looks nothing like I've ever seen an office before. All of the walls were covered in rows and rows and rows of like printed out mock-ups for things. And he was kind of telling me their methodology behind it, and I absolutely love it, where, you know, they'll come in, or when they're preparing a pitch for a client, they'll pick two adjectives and that are very different, you know, so like playfulness, or playful and trustworthy, right? Which those, you know, they're kind of, you know, they're definitely not right next to each other, you know, and you kind of create this 5-point graph between them, and, you know, you create a UI, you know, user experience around each variation of that. And so really playful but not trustworthy, and really trustworthy but not playful, and then, you know, three essentially check marks in between that. And then from there, they literally take it and they'll make 50 mock-ups of one page off of whatever, you know, the client ends up liking the direction of from those two adjectives. And so, you know, I'll go in there, and they were working on a airport's website, and they literally had 50 different variations of the homepage, and like one of them just had one thing different, and like it blew my mind. But, you know, it works really well.
Yeah, that kind of you know, and another thing that I've done before was kind of similar to that, is creating personas,
mm-hmm.
Where you create a user persona. You think of what your user is going to be. Are they going to be a middle-aged mom in, you know, middle America, or are they going to be like a young, you know, jazzy 20-something professional, you know, with lots of disposable income? And creating the persona of your user, you know, who is your user and how they're going to use it. Because how they interact and look at your UI is going to be different, you know. So if you're going for like a professional that's maybe in a law firm, you want things to be a little bit more severe and a little more, you know, jazzed up and hardcore. But if you're going for, you know, a younger generation, maybe you want to soften things up a bit, you know. So you creating, you know, these different personas can help you give a kind of a direction of where to go with it.
Yeah, you know, and one of the big things which a lot of people forget to do is, you know, when they go through that first design phase, you know, they really go through and empathize with the, you know, their direct customer and figure out what the problem is, and even create these personas and, you know, walk through as these personas trying to figure out a solution. And then they get to the point where they'll go through a whole bunch of these different design and mock-up phases, you know, and then they'll move right on to that to implementation, and they'll forget to go back through again a second time and figure out, am I really solving this problem? You know, it might look really cool and it probably like has a good user experience, but am I really solving this problem? You know, because it's hard after so many iterative phases, you know, something could drastically change. And so you have to remember to go back through as those personas, or, you know, with that problem in mind, and make sure you're solving it properly.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's see here. Getting back to our questions. So we've actually been throwing out all kinds of tips and tricks for, you know, how to create good UI, UX. Is there any more tips and tricks that you can think of?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the biggest one is just look around. You know, and I had given that, you know, that tip about looking at all the hotshot startups, you know, with lots of funding. You know, they are usually they have really, really good UI and UX. But, you know, just keep on looking around. I use Hacker News, which is kind of like a Reddit almost. You know, they kind of list, like, you know, cool articles that people are upvoting that are startup and tech focused. And so generally, like, every day, like, the top 10 will be all different websites. And so you can go check them out. But it really is just spend time online looking at websites. That would definitely be probably one tip one. Another one, you know, be really strict about, you know, what you're solving and, you know, how you want the user to solve it. And, like, strip it down, simplify it so only that is there. You know, and Medium does a great job about this. And, you know, they were probably one of the biggest blogging platforms to push to not have a sidebar. You know, and I don't know if you've seen Medium, but they literally just have the big chunk, you know, of text about the article. There's no sidebar. You know, they just have their logo and the header. Really, really simple because, you know, the goal for them is for you to read the article. Wow. And so they stripped it down to everything that you don't need except for reading the article.
I always like the more simplistic design that it just kind of removes clutter. I tend to be one of those people that, you know, when I start getting around clutter, my mind starts getting all confused.
Yeah, well, because, you know, you want to jump to the, you know, you can only remember so much thing. You know, that's why, you know, what I always say in simplifying things is that don't give somebody 7 options because most people will only remember 3.
Yep.
But similarly, don't give them 3 options because they'll only remember 1. So, you know, and another great thing, you know, better to ask for forgiveness, you know, then ask for permission. So there's a lot of sites, and, you know, it's a new thing that a lot of people are shifting to, but when there's buttons to delete things and remove things, you know, generally you'll have to hit a button and then they'll be like, are you sure you want to delete this? Yes, I clicked the button. Like, of course I want to, you know. And so in my mind, that's a really bad user experience, but it was kind of like this general thing that just everybody did just in case you accidentally hit the button.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm seeing more and more, and, you know, what a lot of people are doing, because it's really great, is, you know, you hit that button, it deletes it, and then there'll be a, you know, a nice little bar at the bottom or something saying, you just deleted that item. And then there's an undo button, you know, because better to let them do it, you know, because most of the time people were clicking on it for purpose. You know, you don't need to have them click twice to do something.
Yeah.
I kind of hated that Mint. I use Mint for all my, you know, finances and stuff like that. And I guess maybe I'm an edge case because I was removing cards and putting in cards a lot, and maybe people don't do that. But, you know, when you go to delete, like, an account from their system, you literally hit the, like, delete card button, and then you literally have to type in the word delete in all caps to delete it. And I'm like, I clicked the button. Why do I have to do this, you know? You know, another thing to stay away from is, you know, I talk a lot about you trying to, you know, figuring out what you want to achieve and then helping the user achieve it. But, you know, don't stretch too far, you know. A really great example I have of this is I was setting up a Venmo account the other day. It took me forever. I don't know why I didn't have one already. But, you know, they have the general thing that a lot of sites have now where they have, like, a checklist of things to do to set up your, you know, to get to 100% account setup, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, people are coming to the site to do something specifically. And, you know, maybe, again, I am an edge case, but, you know, they wanted you to add a bank account, add a card, invite your friends, and all of this stuff. And it's in their sidebar there. And I'm, like, at 60%. And I'm, like, I'm done. This is all I need it for.
Yeah.
Go away. And you can't remove it. Like, it's there. I'm, like, I'm never going to invite my friends to this. Like, just go away. I don't want that there, you know. So you have to be careful of overreaching because from a business perspective, obviously, they, you know, you want your users to share with their friends, but at the same time, don't stretch so far, you know, because people aren't going to add a credit card, a bank account, and a debit card to your system. Generally, I mean, and again, maybe I'm an edge case, but.
Yeah, and I've seen several type of sites that I think are interesting at first, and I start going through the pathway and through the login, you know, so I put in my email address, my username, my password, and then the next page is that share page, you know, which is fine, you know, I can always, you know, most of the time can ignore that, but I've seen this new thing where they're trying to force you to share, So it could be, you know, giving access to your accounts, and so then they send an email out to all of your accounts. You know, LinkedIn kind of did that back in the day. But then, or it could be, you know, that it's going to post something to your wall. But it's one of those user experiences where I now completely stop myself and say, okay, do I really need to even get into this site and just to check it out? Because, you know, especially these days, giving that access to, you know, your users, your friends and family, your Facebook wall, it has a lot of risk to it. And so, yeah, it's one of those user experiences now that I'm, you know, I completely stop myself and say, okay, no, they're asking for too much now.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and, you know, it just gets to a point where it's like a lot of users just don't want to see it anymore. You know, I go to LinkedIn and they still want me to finish building my profile and put what university I went to.
Yeah.
And there's no like text field there for me to say, I didn't go to university. I don't need to add a university, you know, but they prompt me every single time I go. They're like, add your university, you know, add what college you went to, but I didn't go to university or college. And I probably never will. So, you know, that's one of those things where it's just, sometimes you have to be, you know, let the user get rid of stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, another trick that I always look at doing is, you know, well, when I review a site that of things that needs to change, one of the first things I always look for is a lot of redundancy. You know, do you have a setting button down here and up here, and they're both going to the same thing? So why do you have them both?
Yeah.
There's two reasons for that. One is it's just adding more clutter, but two, you're training your users two different things. So you might have half of your users using one settings and then the other half using the other settings, and then it gets confusing, especially, you know, from a customer service standpoint. Oh, go ahead, click the settings. Well, which one?
You know? Yeah. Well, you know, and then that becomes an issue when you go to, you know, redesign or restructure the site and half the people are doing different things.
Exactly.
You know, but kind of on the flip side of that as well, you know, if the intent of whatever page you're on is to get to the settings, then having it in two places might be okay. It just, you know, it really all depends because, you know, if like the whole point of a page is to convert a user, having more than one sign up button on the page can be okay, you know, if it helps you convert the user more. If you have six buttons on the page and people are only clicking the first and the last one, remove all the other ones. They don't need to be there. You know, that's where it's one of those things where you know, maybe you implement it and push it out to people or A/B test it, but you go back and revisit it, you know, a week or two down the road when you have data about it. And then be like, okay, does this really need to be there?
Yeah.
You know, and so a lot of times it doesn't. So
exactly. So another one too is as you're starting to get into the design process, or actually even before, really focus on what platforms you're going for. Are you going for, you know, computers? Are you going for a mobile experience? Are you going for you know, PlayStation, Xbox? You know, so something that you're going to build that's going to appear there as well. And because each of those platforms are going to have a different control function, it's going to have a different. They're going to take different user inputs. So, for instance, a person using a website on their computer, well, they have a mouse and keyboard, so they can easily type things in and click on things. They have the hover, so they can hover their mouse over things and have drop-down menus. But if you go to say, okay, I want that site to also work on an iPad, well, iPad, there's no way for you to hover your finger over a menu and have it drop down. So you have to start looking at all of those little changes in the interface and the user interface and how that's going to affect the user experience down the road because you know they're interacting with your product or your site in a very different way.
Yeah, you know, and you know, a lot of things that I'm seeing more and more is the people are going with bigger interfaces all around. So to give some context, like on an iPad or on an iPhone, Apple's like general guidelines, you know, and that's just a guideline, like people ignore it all the time, but they generally, like the rule of thumb is, you know, the button has to be at least 44 pixels by 44 pixels for, you know, the average size thumb to click on it. But, you know, all the time you see all these like really small interfaces and stuff and you have to zoom in to click on things. But it's interesting seeing the shift now where desktop sites are going with these bigger, larger interfaces and simpler interfaces because
you know, it translates really well, and it's the exact same on an iPhone, you know.
Yeah.
And so, like, MailChimp does a really great job where, you know, they just rolled out their new, it's like a fluid user interface where, you know, it literally just scales up and down when you scale the page, but everything's really big. You know, if you literally, like, took that desktop site and put it on an iPad without changing anything, you could still use it the same way you would on the desktop, so.
Yeah, yeah. Though I have seen the opposite. The biggest culprit of this, and, you know, a lot of people are fuming about it, is that the newest Windows that came out.
Mm-hmm.
So Windows 8, they had some good goals in mind, you know, to create an operating system that could work on any system. So if I had it on my tablet, if I had it on my PC, it all works the same. But what they kind of messed up on, you know, well, I say they messed up on, you know, is that they really enforced this new tablet model onto the desktop.
Yeah, the Metro View, I think they
call
it, or
something.
Yeah, the
Metro View. And so the biggest example that I can give that where this was a mess up is that so your start menu is now the Metro. So you click on your start menu, it takes over your whole screen. And so usually on a desktop computer, I have a huge monitor. So that's taking over like a giant monitor. But then say I want to do something simple, like, you know, I was looking at a web page. I was, maybe looking to purchase something, but I want to kind of do some calculations. And so I click on the calculator. Well, they have it so it defaults to the Metro calculator, which takes up the entire screen.
Yeah.
So now you have this gigantic calculator taking up your whole screen, but then you can't see the thing that you're trying to do calculations on in the background. So then you have to, you know, figure out, okay, I got to grab this and to close it, and then I have to search through this menu to find the actual calculator that's the desktop calculator. So that's where, I think I've seen the opposite mess up happen where, you know, the Windows was really trying to go for this, you know, mobile experience that, you know, could apply to anywhere, but then they forgot about the desktop experience and ended up enforcing this like mobile experience on the desktop. And now they're trying to, you know, the last
they're
couple
rolling
releases,
it back.
Yeah, they're trying to, you know, roll back some of those decisions. So now it boots directly into that desktop view rather than your Metro view and stuff. But
yeah, you know, and that's, you know, a classic case of, you know, and for all we know, internally they like are forgetting about power users. You know, maybe that was their goal, and that's why, you know, they released it this way. But, you know, in my view of it, I think they kind of just lost those personas of their actual users because. And, you know, I don't know any exact statistics, but, you know, there is a really big base of Windows users who are like gamers, for example. You know, they're, you know, heavy gamers. They don't use the consoles because they don't, you know, they don't have big enough processors and video cards and stuff. And so they build these power PCs to do really heavy gaming on things.
I'm one of those.
Yeah.
I have, like, quad cards in my...
Exactly. See, you know, but it's, you know, it's the... And, you know, maybe in their eyes, you guys are edge cases, and maybe that's why, you know, it rolled out this way to begin with. But, you know, I mean, it could have been as simple as when you set up the computer, do you consider yourself more of a basic user or more of an advanced user?
Yeah.
But, and now they're realizing with all this lashback... That, you know, and they're again defaulting it back to that desktop view. Yeah, you know, but you know, and I don't know if I agree with them defaulting it back to this desktop view because, like, my mom, for example, who, you know, isn't very computer savvy, would probably be better off using the, you know, their mobile view on the desktop. But you know, so give and play, and you know, we could sit here and criticize it all we want, but you know, from their perspective too, you know, it's difficult. So.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, what I always say is when you make a mess in the world, you know, I'm considering a mess. When you go that route, the best thing to do is, you know, keep moving forward and fixing it to make it better. So now they have all this feedback of, you know, users that are saying, oh, you know, we need this back and stuff. So make those changes, and so then you can have the best of both worlds.
Yeah, so. You know, and again, they do – one of the things that I love is they've done a great job of, you know, that kind of last phase of, you know, they go back and, you know, they look at it again, you know, a month down the road, which I'm sure they already knew before they released it people were going to freak out. But, you know, they go back and they're, you know, releasing these new versions where they're not – they might be rolling it back, but, you know, maybe in their eyes they're stepping forward. You know, I haven't been following it as much, but, you know, at least they're going back and looking at it and trying to change it to make it, you know, fit better.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of times, you know, like with Vista, You know, they kind of just put it out there and everybody hated it, but they're like, sorry, you know, you're going to have to wait for the next release in 2 years, you know. So, you know, I definitely, you know, think they're doing a great thing in that respect. So, you know, they've been really good with, you know, kind of rolling back or going forward with these, you know, older features. So.
Yeah, yeah. And recently they are speeding the process up as well, which I think is going to help them significantly, you know, get over some of the bumps and
hurdles.
And, yeah. And it's going to be interesting once the new CEO comes into helm. I don't think they've chosen one yet, or?
I unfortunately do not remember his name. Yeah. I read tons of articles about it, but I have a really bad memory for names, so.
Yeah, so it's going to be interesting to see where it goes now.
Yeah, well, and the funny thing, side anecdote here, is I don't remember his name, but I remember exactly how much they're paying him over the next 10 years. From one of the articles, it blows me away what I remember, so.
So getting back on topic, so how do you learn user interface and user experience? What's some of the resources out there?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, really good blogs, and, you know, maybe I can give you a list to put on the page of, you know, blogs to follow with all, you know, these ideas and stuff. You know, a lot of it's just really just getting out there and seeing what other people are doing. You know, I have this little, like, I use the iPhone notes for a lot of things, for my getting things done and stuff, and I just have a note in there that whenever I, like, I've forced myself that whenever I feel delighted by a user experience or the opposite, you know, where I think it's terrible user experience, I write it down, I put the URL or, you know, the pathway to how I, you know, so I can recreate it, and then every night I'll go through any of the new ones that I've added and really sit down and analyze, you know, and be like, you know, what was the problem they were trying to solve, you know, and it's hard from the outside trying to figure that out, but if you sit and analyze it, you can generally, you know, try and figure it out.
Yeah.
And then figure out, you know, were they successful, you know, how could they change things, and a lot of times I've been forcing myself to write down the better ones, so I have this, like, list of better, you know, or really good UI decisions, but with the bad ones, you know, it'll come to a point where if there's something really, really bad that I think is terrible, you know, I'll sit and analyze it and maybe either come up with solutions or just know that it doesn't work, and, you know, I'll try and ping the company where, you know, the problem is, which a lot of times I don't get, you know, emails back from them, but there has been times where they're like, wow, this is really good feedback. You know, if everybody did this, our product would be amazing. So
yeah, I actually do that a lot myself. Where sometimes I'll just have this experience and I'll just, okay, I need to type it all out. And
yeah, exactly. You know, or,
company.
You know,
if they do something with it, great. If not, oh yeah. Well, but at least, you know, I got it off my chest.
Yeah. And, you know, and Twitter helps with that too. You know, you can just tweet out to people all the time. And, you know, I was having problems getting tickets to an event because Eventbrite was being weird, and I tweeted out to them. They're like, "Oh, don't worry, blah blah blah, we'll fix it." You know, so you know, it's there's a lot of great ways to get in contact and let people know what they're doing wrong. And you know, if you do that and then push other people to do that, and then there's enough of us doing that, then you know, you'll get feedback from random people about your product as well. So
yeah, yeah, and then kind of going back to what you're saying there, that was one of the suggestions I was going to throw out too is. To really go through sites and dissect them,
mm-hmm.
you know, to find out, you know, go to a site that you love and figure out why you love it, you know, take it piece by piece, you know, is it the floating menu? So when you hover over that menu and do you feel a little like, whoo, you know, I had that the other day where it was this guy's website, unfortunately I can't remember the full site, it was just a resume site. But, you know, he had his name printed in, it looked like a 3D, you know, kind of font, you know, where it was kind of popping out. And then you roll your cursor over it, and it does this neat little roll effect, and it kind of pops down to just like a regular font.
Okay.
But just the effect that he did just gave me a little like, woo, that's nice.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like really cool. But yeah, go through sites and figure out, you know, what are the things that delight you like that, and really pick it apart. You know, figure out, okay, is it the animation? Is it the font, the way it looks? You know, and it's kind of funny because it's one of those things where you have to really start to get in touch with your emotions. You know?
Definitely.
It's
yeah.
Like, how is this making me feel inside? And it sounds, you know, silly sometimes. You know, you're looking at it and you're like, am I feeling anything? But, you know, everything has a feeling to it.
Yeah.
It's just really find that feeling. And then on the flip side of that, you know, go to sites that you hate. And figure out why do you hate them? What is it, you know, what is the frustration yeah. coming from? Is it because you click on something and it just doesn't work or what?
Definitely.
So looks like So what are other places to learn? One other place I always point people to is Treehouse. They've been really good. Treehouse and then Lynda.com. They both have some really great videos that they've been posting. And what I like about them is they kind of encompass all different subjects. And so you can start off learning some of the basics of UI and UX. But then if you, and then as you start learning that, you can start expanding into other areas. Like, okay, so I learned UI, UX, and got some of the basics here, but what about coloration? You know, what's some proper ways to use color? And then what about, you know, creating a JavaScript drop-down menus? And, you know, it starts leading you to other avenues of it and to help, you know, give you a bigger picture, I guess, of it.
Yeah, definitely, you know, and kind of going back to that whole Medium thing where I was saying they've stripped everything down, there's a lot of blogs that haven't, so you can go to them and, you know, click in their related articles on the sidebar to find stuff that's similar to it. So
yeah. And then another good way that, you know, I do with, you know, product management, and it's pretty any profession out there you can do this with, is get out there and meet people. Go to meetups, go to conferences, go to these hubs where thought, you know, process, you know, thoughts are, you know, happening, and you know, the creative process is going on. Another great thing is like the startup weekends or lean machine startup weekends, or any place where you get hands-on and you're kind of forcing yourself to really think about it and think about it fast. Not only does it kind of push you to really get creative without, you know, any boundaries, you know, because when you're doing a weekend like that, it's not like, okay, I have a boss above me who, if I do, you know, the wrong little thing, they're going to be like, you know, pissed off and something like fired.
Yeah.
So you don't really have those kind of boundaries. You do have the boundaries within your team, making sure, you know, everybody's on the same page and you're working together on a thing. But I think that just enhances the creativity that comes out of it. And then you get to see what other people create too. So
definitely.
So, you know, sometimes you'll be working on the same type of problem. Different teams will be working on the same type of problems. And then you get to see their presentation at the end and be like, wow, I didn't think of things that way.
Exactly.
That is a brilliant way of thinking of it.
Yeah.
So those were some of my suggestions.
For sure, yeah.
Do you have any more there?
No, I mean, yeah. I mean, a lot of it, you know, you can just find stuff online. You know, that's what I just go through and try and find resources. And then you'll end up finding, you know, because I tend to learn better with particular types of writing styles. And so, you know, I have eventually found, you know, blogs that I really like where it's a lot easier for me to interpret and understand things. So, you know, it's just a matter of going out and, you know, just find a whole bunch of blogs, and you'll eventually realize which ones you like better than others and just check those, you know.
All right. So we're coming at our end here. So how can people get a hold of you?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm really responsive on, you know, email, Twitter too. I mean, I have it send push notifications to my phone. So, but you can always email me case case at casesandberg.com, and then also at casesandberg is my Twitter handle. So, you know, either of those, feel free to shoot me any questions you have, any thoughts. Meet up for coffee or drinks, you know, whatever.
Yeah. And are you still doing your photography as well?
Yeah, a little bit on the side. Yeah, just for fun. So.
Okay, he's a great photographer, by the way. So, okay, well, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks,
you know,
so much.
It's been really great.
Yeah.
And, you know, UI, UX, you know, like I said at the beginning, it's one of those things that just keeps popping up nowadays, and everybody's asking for that type of experience. But then there's a lot of like, okay, what does that really mean and stuff? So thank you for all of the input and the help on this.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I had a lot of fun sitting here dissecting this stuff with you, so.
Wonderful. Okay, thanks, and have a great day.
This has been an episode of Product Superheroes, and we thank you for joining us. You can check out more episodes on either productsuperheroes.com, or we are syndicated on the Global Product Management Talk, ProdMGMTTALK.com, where you can find this show among several other great shows. You can also check out startupproduct.com for information on some great meetups and training sessions coming in the near future. We also love hearing from our listeners, so if you have any questions, comments, or know of a product superhero we should have on, please reach me at bob@productsuperheroes.com or on Twitter at MightyBobarian, MightyBobarian. Thanks, everybody, and remember, if you don't love what you build, how the heck will anyone else?